Welcome, everyone, to the Feeling Lighter podcast. I'm Katie, here with our incredible co-host, Dr. Lisa Folden. Hey. As a reminder, the intention of the podcast is that we are shedding old beliefs one episode at a time, because the bottom line is how you feel about yourself changes everything in your life. So I'm really excited today, Lisa, about our guest. I actually went to Dr. Nikki's event in Berkeley recently. I found her on social media. I am obsessed with the work that she's doing. I think she is such an incredibly intelligent, bright, I just love talking with her. So when I went to her event, I had asked her team, would she maybe want to come on my podcast?
Maybe.
And they were like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God. Okay. So let's get right into it. Why don't you go over her bio, and then we will start asking some of our very important questions. It's a very important episode.
Happy to read this very impressive bio. When asked why she has focused so much of her professional life on advancing racial equity, Nikki Lanier will tell you it was an assignment passed to her in utero. Born to parents who were immersed in the civil rights movement, Nikki was raised on the campus of Hampton University, one of the country's most prominent HBCUs, and as a child was taught to see the advancement of Black people as a birthright and an imperative to a civilized society. She was raised in a loving home that nurtured her curiosity around these principles, but also assured her confidence in articulating the same. Now, as CEO and founder of Harper Slade, one of the fastest growing and most highly recognized racial equity advisory firms in the country, her work focuses on helping organizations cultivate environments where Black and brown talent can thrive. Nikki has also founded two global coaching programs, one for inclined white women who want to become better racial equity advocates in their home, workplace, and community. And the other, a coaching program, is for professional Black women who are in need of ripening and respite. Nikki is an experienced leader with over 25 years of career achievements that span banking, labor and employment law, collective bargaining, human resources, and state government, a three-time private and public sector chief human resource officer, and previous executive with the Federal Reserve. Nikki serves on several nonprofit and corporate boards and has spoken at conferences all over the world on topics ranging from race, work, and economics to women in leadership and transforming HR. That is so impressive. I'm so excited to meet you. Welcome to the Feeling Lighter podcast.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much. And thank you for taking the time to read that bio that's probably way too long now that I'm listening to it. And
it's totally fine.
No, it actually answered my first question, which, how did you get in this work? And and it seems like that's pretty obvious given your childhood and your upbringing. So I want to go right into, because you have like multiple organizations happening here, which is incredible. So I want to talk a little bit more about, can you just give us a brief, like for each organization that you're running, like a little bit more in depth about what the intention and the purpose behind, you know, the mission behind each of those are? Because I feel like One should resonate with someone.
For sure.
So maybe we could go into that just a little bit.
Sure. So if you, they all point to 2045, where Black and brown people will be among the demographic majority. And so each of my business kind of strategic imperatives really point to how can we differently and transformationally prepare ourselves today for that tomorrow. So Harper Slade is a advisory firm that works with companies, corporations, organizations to help them understand the imperative around cultivating environments where Black and brown talent can thrive. Mm-hmm. So it is the kind of employment-centric model, looking at employee engagement strategies and workforce pipeline strategies to assure that the browner citizen can find his or her way toward potent and well-activated unleashing of their full talent at work. The Rare Woman Collective is a program suite for white women who are interested in, curious about, want to know more about how to advance racial equity in every single space that they hold, who are as angry at racism as Black and brown folks are, and who want to be a part of creating a world where racism can't live. And so the idea is that if we could teach white women who already want to learn this work how to advocate well with other white people, on the advancement of these principles, given the proximity that white women have to white people in ways that people like me don't. If I could teach you how, what to say, how to identify resistance, how to think about this work in a grace-filled manner, what attributes must be true of you, how to think about your advocacy in laser-sharp ways, then my thought is we could begin to pave the way to assure that the 2045 reality around the advancing demographic feels demonstrably differently. Lastly, the Slayed Woman cohort is specifically for Black women, working with Black women, activating Black communities to assure that in as much as we are going to be a part of the demographic majority, might as well be meaningfully represented in the nation's economy and in our political structures and social structures. So what decisions are we making today in our homes, in our professions, with regard even to the way that we raise our children? What about the today decisions will position Black America differently for the advancements to come?
No, we're like, that is, I feel like you've just covered all, like all of the areas, you know, where racism, you know, negatively impacts us. Like if every player in that position is doing their part, like the world is going to look so different.
And it benefits everybody.
And it benefits everybody. And that's the thing.
And that's what, and so like, I want to start with this first concept because I think, so, you know, it's difficult when we're planning these podcasts, right? We're a fitness app, mm-hmm. but we really believe in mentality shift, yes. because we really believe that the fitness industry is inundated with toxic messages around diet and exercise. Mm-hmm. And we believe that when people shift their mentality and come home to themselves, we can actually have a much better world. So the mentality side is huge. And that's why we have this podcast. So sometimes people are like, Katie, why are you talking about racism on the podcast? And I'm like, because it's like part of like, that's like the premise of why all of this even exists.
Absolutely.
And so I think I just need to address that from the beginning. This is a root systemic issue that impacts all of us, whether you want to look at it or not.
That part.
And so if we're talking about mentality shifts in our own lives to feel better and more connected with ourselves, we're talking about racism.
Yep.
And I'm here to do that. And we're all here to do that. And so that's why we're doing it, because it's a root thing and we're not going to ignore it. Yep. So, you know, although I will say when I went to your event, I had to shift some of my mentality because we'll get into that in a minute, because I want you to discuss the difference between equality and equity. I think mm-hmm. that's an important concept that we all need to be better understanding of.
The premise on which both sit are very different. So let me start with the easiest way to answer that. Equality chases sameness. Equity chases proportional fairness. Mm-hmm. And so it's an idea of equality presumes a broad swath that the same doling out for community, for members, for individuals, for people is tantamount to a just and fair society. Mm-hmm. And while I would argue there was a point where that was absolutely the case, though we've lost that window. Mm-hmm. Maybe 100 years ago.
Right.
That window has kind of closed. We could have pursued, I think, earnestly equal rights, equal justice, equal access, equal opportunities. We could have, and ostensibly tried by trotting out various laws and rules and policy, but we never really got at the root of our belief systems, to your point. Mm-hmm. So those laws continue to be subject to the frailty of our beliefs. Equity, though, at this point, because I talk so much about 2045 to the point that it'll probably get on y'all's nerves before this is all
said. No, never.
But that demographic reality has significant consequences when you think about what must be true of a world where the majority of the citizens that are in it, the majority of the population, really must be able to play well as a part of the structures that govern that system. So said differently, how does a world work where the majority of our citizen body can't afford themselves of appropriate and sustained access to the fundamentals of the economy, the fundamentals of the political and the social structures because of race? What does that society look like? What does it feel like, if not apartheid, right? Mm. And so when I talk about equity at this point, it is like, what is proportionally fair to happen only for and through Black and brown people, such that that kind of focus could help amplify and accelerate the economic vibrancy of the very group that we're going to be relying on. So I, you know, I'm fairly narrow in the way that I talk about equity. It's almost exclusively on the issue of race, because perhaps gender too, but it's a different urgency around the 2045 reality. So while I do think that when we're thinking about gender issues in particular, we should look at equity in the way that I've just described it, because of this, there's so many years of policy rooted unfairness. Mm-hmm. Equity says there must be also so many years of policy rooted unfairness, I guess. So, mm-hmm. right. But just differently scaled. I think that's true both for women and for people of color. But I think there's a different acuity for people of color.
Yeah. I appreciate that you're doing this work, because I know that, and this has come up in recent podcasts, you say that what you offer to white women is specifically to white women who are inclined to hear this information and want to learn. And I think that is so important, because the labor, especially of Black people, going into this, like having to teach and educate and train and help people understand, you can't do that to someone with someone who has no inclination and is like just set on believing racism doesn't exist, white supremacy is not a thing, what is wrong with you, are you crazy? And people still say this to this day, like to this day, it's not a thing, get over it, just treat people fair, it's fine, there's no such thing as white privilege. Like, these are like real life, real time comments. And so I think, I don't know if you want to speak to that idea that like having these conversations with people who are like certain that they don't want to get it is really kind of fruitless at this point, or if you agree with that or not, but having the conversation with people who are inclined and understand what systems we exist under so that we can try to dismantle it together. It's a game changer. It's different.
Yeah. Yeah. Lisa, there's a lot there. So I guess I'd foundationally just share, when I talk about creating a world where racism can't live, it's not conjecture for me and mm-hmm. Kind of a Pollyanna-ish statement. It is in my heart and in my mind an unimpeachable inevitability. And so I see that as our true north. I see that as my personal true north. I see that as a true north for the company. It informs everything. The way that I parent, the way that I lead, the way that I show up in community, that premise informs everything. And it sounds absolutely crazy. I understand that, but I'm okay with that because that's what visions are.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, my work, I think I am my most impactful when I can reach the inclined white woman, the inclined white woman that already has a heart around this work, or at least some level of curiosity around this work. Right. But I also recognize that it is that white woman that, because of her proximity in community with other white people, is in a better position to reach the non-inclined white woman.
Yes.
Far better than I could, right? Mm-hmm. There's too much noise that has to be overcome for me to try to reach the uninclined, though I would try. Let me be very clear. It is very tiring, but because of my ministry. I mean, right, I see this working anyways as that. And because I'm unmoved off of that premise, I would not mind putting forth the effort. I just don't think I'd be effectual in it in the way that a white woman could, who is mm-hmm. practiced in that area and prepared for and has some, you know, opportunities to work with coaching around. I think that there's a way to get her there in a way that I couldn't.
Great point.
You know, one of my favorite things about you that really surprised me. I mean, it didn't surprise me because I've talked with you before and then I'm like, okay, this is so aligned with, I can see it now, but was that I kind of believed in the past before I went to your event that my feeling of, you know, inequality and inequity, like my feeling around that was enough for people to say, oh my God, like, of course we should be talking about this. And I was enraged when I would go to, like, for instance, like I would go to like a business event and there'd be mostly wealthy white men and I'd be like, let's have this conversation. And they're like, absolutely not. And I'm like, but don't you see, like, you have so much power and like we could do something, like, isn't it inspiring? Like, can't you, shouldn't we do this? And they're like, don't talk to me. Like, and so I was like enraged. And you are so strategic. And I realized at your event, Katie, your feelings, I am so sorry. But you have to put those aside because they're actually not making progress. And we need to get, because that's been my biggest question, is like, how the hell do we get buy-in from people who don't care? Yeah. And I'm like, and you're like, I have you, but you're enraged, you know, feelings are not really going to help the situation. I felt my enraged feelings were justified. And your event showed me that it actually was probably harming more than it was helping. So I had to have a little look in the mirror and have a little adjustment around, okay, how are you going to approach this? So I want to take this opportunity to move.
We'll be back in just a moment.
We want to make sure everyone knows about WeShape, the company we founded to offer people a different approach to health and fitness. Most health and fitness apps use shame and self-judgment as tools to push you to exercise more so you can lose weight. But at WeShape, we gently guide you towards approaching your workouts as an act of self-care rather than an act of self-judgment. On top of that, we've invested heavily in a technology behind our workouts so we can deliver a personalized workout plan centered around functional movements you can do from home that will help you feel better in your body. If you want to try WeShape out for free, click the link in our podcast description or go to weshape.com/free, where you can build your first workout and activate your 2-week free trial.
And now back to the Feeling Lighter podcast.
Move into your strategic, I mean, I love the way that you view this and to talk about your strategy and to talk about, I mean, when you said, let's talk about the economy, I was like, oh, that's how she gets to these people. And then I like kind of rewound and I was like, if I went to the people at that event and said, I want to have this really powerful economic discussion with you, it would have gone very differently.
Very different.
So maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be really strategic in this work. This is change management work at its core. It is fraught with all kinds of emotional entanglement. And, you know, Katie, I think it's important. I hope I didn't misspeak on this during the event, but your feelings, all of our feelings on this are absolutely valid, mm-hmm. And understandable, including the feelings of the white men that you were talking to, who are like, again with racism discussions or whatever, right? So there's an emotional trigger, let's be honest, that we all
have. No, you validated my feelings.
Right?
You just helped me realize that my strategy wasn't the best one. Yeah.
If I'm fair, a lot of us do this. A lot of us people who do the work that I do, we lead out of anger.
Yeah.
We emote at the same time we're trying to strategize and to teach and to give counsel to and advise. And it's hard for those, at least in my experience, it was hard for those two to coexist well. Mm-hmm. Like something has to get in front. That's not to say my emotions are gone, but they can't be the forward facing reality of how I'm engaging with you. Because one of the attributes that we talk about with Rare is that my goal is not to clap back on you and to guilt and shame you into anything. My goal is to recognize that you, like I, have been taught this whole narrative about the value of Black and brown people. And we just haven't done a good job at jettisoning that. Some of us like it, actually. Some people like the fact that there's these mattering, as a matter of fact, and mattering contextual. Some people thrive on that. But there's emotions all throughout it. And we can't disrupt and discourage someone in or out of any kind of belief system, right? So we talk about, I'm not trying to push you out of yours. I'm trying to invite you into mine. And that's a different posture in terms of how you're engaging. And so just really thinking about who am I vis-a-vis this advocacy moment? What is my goal? What is the intended outcome? And who am I looking at when I'm talking to this person? It's not just a white male or not just a Republican or not just a, who else do we have? A Christian, right? It's not just that person is more than that. There's a mother in there. There's a father in there. There's a child who didn't get something. There's a vulnerability. There's a, anchoring of like who I am is what I believe. And if you're telling me not to believe that, I don't know what to do with the rest of how I feel about who I am. So like just being sensitive to, not to say we got to solve everybody's stuff, right? But just understanding that if my goal is to get into your heart and to get into your hearing, this clapback cussing out, I'm going to call you out, I'm going to put you in your place, it doesn't change much. It just corrects in the moment.
I think that that's a really important detail to have.
Yeah.
I didn't cuss anybody out, or I didn't get to there was just a lot of literature being texted through on Threads. But what I think you're speaking to is that, you know, I'll just have my own self-disclosure here. It was that I felt justified in this narrative. So I felt like I didn't have to look beyond that. I didn't have to look because I'm like, you're the person who has the most privilege and the most power and the most wealth. Like, you don't get to have those other things. Mm. And in at the time, I didn't realize that actually that was not helping my cause.
No, yeah.
And so I just felt justified in that narrative because I'm like, who are you? You have everything and the system completely benefits you. And of course you don't want to look at that. And I'm angry because of it. And that doesn't, while that anger should have a space, it's actually not helping. And so I think that it was like really important when I went to your event to redefine, okay, this is a person on the other side of that who, again, like you said, has their own experiences, their own childhood. They're a human. They're a mother. Mother or father. They're these things that are part of them. And if your actual goal is to evoke change, your justified narrative around just being angry and pointing the finger is not really going to work. And right. So I just appreciate that nuanced piece around looking beyond just the label of like white, wealthy, Republican, Christian male. Like I appreciate that because that allowed me to soften. It still gave me a space for my anger around the situation, you know, around racism, but it allowed me to shift how I could go about this. And so can we move into, because you blew me out of the water with your economic strategic, like the 2045, like you, that just, my mind was just, whoa. So can we go into that a little bit?
Sure. Okay. So yeah. So I used to work for the Fed and I did a lot of work side by side of economists who were studying this stuff all the time and just thankfully got a lot of exposure to it. So for those of you, your listeners, your viewers who are familiar with the work of the Fed, you know that the Federal Reserve promulgates monetary policy, basically sets the federal funds rate, how much money costs to borrow. Congress promulgates economic policy, fiscal policy, like infrastructure stuff. And so both of those entities are very reliant on how the middle class is showing up, median income earners. And so in this inflationary period, it's anywhere between $60,000 to $120,000 income earners are decidedly in the median income middle class. And so when monetary policymakers come together to determine whether they're going to be tinkering with those interest rates, and when fiscal policymakers come together to determine infrastructure spend, the first place they look is to the middle class. And they like got armies of economists who are coming in with all these binders and just telling them, here's what's happening in this community, in this county, in this census tract, in this state at this period of time. They're like just inundating them. Basically, what the policymakers are looking at is like savings and investments, spending habits by household balance sheet. They're looking at higher education attainment, home ownership rates, like all those indicators that the economy is doing well or not. Now, for our nation's history, since we've been together, and certainly since we've been paying attention to policymaking this way, we've always had white people make up the majority in the middle class, always well represented throughout, always. They've always been the numeric majority, and they've always been arguably the least encumbered, not absence of encumbrance, but the least encumbered in getting into middle class. So it's just been like, well, we've never had to think about who actually must be in the middle class in order for this to work. So the idea is whomever is the majority in the available working class, the majority available working adults, should also be well represented in the middle class in order for policymaking to work. So saying all this to say, well, by 2045, we're going to be relying on the majority of our citizen body to be well represented in the middle class. The majority of the citizen body will be Hispanic and Black. And to date, as we sit here today on this day in March 2024, Black households and Hispanic households have never been meaningfully represented in the middle class, ever, in our country's history. Wow. And so what I talk about is that we have 21 years to fix what we've not been able to do in 400 from an economic policy standpoint. The last point on that is that, you know, we know, and it is dispositive, as has been studied by the Fed and several other organizations, that the biggest impediment to Black and brown economic mobility is the way that we experience racism. So that's why I have that are doing all this crazy stuff. Like, okay, we got to have somebody dealing with what's happening at work. Somebody's got to deal with what's happening in white households. Somebody else has got to deal with what's happening in Black households, because 2045 is right around the corner. Really, so that's why I kind of think about this work in that way. And I try to talk about it in that way, not a social justice framework, not a right thing to do framework. Both are important, but they don't mobilize. And they're not controlling at this point.
Yes. Economics, money, that does mobilize. That's a fact.
And, you know, the thing about that is there's none of us that's unscathed by that. So that's not a black or white issue, right?
Yes.
So all the economy is important. It drives so much in terms of how we have discerned comfort and how we move about our daily lives. So we really all stand to win by accelerated black and brown economic activation.
I mean, when I came back from her event, I was like, this woman cracked the code.
Yeah, right.
Like, I literally was like, this is the way to mobilize this. Yeah. And now I'm a little bit, can I still be sad that like people don't want to just do it because that's, in my opinion, the right thing to do? Yes. But I just thought it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, we got to have her on the podcast because people have to know, like, whether you want to talk about this from the lens of social justice or not, whether you want to talk about it through the lens of whatever, deconstructing these beliefs and deconstructing racism and understanding how it shows up in our everyday life will have an impact on you, whether you like it or not.
Right.
Can you talk about, like, so I did not know this. I did not recognize that in this 2045 thing. So I think I'm just intrigued by the whole understanding of that. But can you talk to the specifics of what that looks like? Like, how, I think the question we had is like, how, what's the economic impact for everybody of just ignoring racism and just pretending it doesn't exist and not doing anything to address it? Like, your companies aren't in play. They're not, you're not doing this work. What does 2045 look like for us as a nation? Like, what is that?
It looks like apartheid. So, and that very simply is defined as a country where the majority of the citizen body, and that majority is minority or black or brown, having little or episodic experience with the fundamentals of how the economy works. And the full access is retained by the demographic minority. Mm-hmm. That's apartheid. And we know that apartheid only ends in a couple of ways. It almost always involves some sort of economic decline, like significant economic decline, high levels of volatility, national security issues. It devalues the currency of the country in which that apartheid is occurring, and civil unrest. So there, you know, if it's hard to fathom, major, like, the United States apartheid, like, get out of here, right? It's hard to fathom that. But that, by definition, once black and brown are majority adults, that's where we will be in our current trajectory. And so it's like really important for us to kind of frame and think about it in that construct. In terms of costs, I don't know if this number is correct because my brain is a little hazy at the moment. But there's a study that has been promulgated by the San Francisco Fed, 2021. And it's called Economic Gains from Equity. I believe that's what it's called. And in that study, not only was it made very clear that, you know, racism is the biggest threat to the nation's economy, and that racism is has been the biggest threat to economic mobility for black and brown people, but it also quantifies the cost. I think it was something like $16 trillion has been lost in GDP just in the last maybe 10, 15 years. Due exclusively, not primarily, exclusively to race-based inequities. And so as we think about that reality, when we're not the demographic majority, what will be true, to your question, by 2045 when we are, in terms of the lost opportunity costs and the absence, what could have been realized by way of GDP gain and the like. So we're just, we continue to cut off our nose to spite our face on this topic.
You know, I you brought up that research article in your event, and I have that actually open in my computer right now. We will include that in the show notes so people can take a read at that, because it is really informative and can give you more of the kind of the data that you're speaking to. So we will make sure to include that in the show notes as well if you want to read that article.
Economic Great.
Equity, what it's called. Yeah. Read it again, Connor.
The Economic Gains from Equity.
The Economic Gains from Equity is the name of the article. We will definitely include it in the show notes so people can read that. Lisa, did you have any other questions? I know you're wrong.
My brain is just spinning, and I don't know. I think I'm so impressed by what you're doing and so proud of it, and having a better understanding of the why behind it and how it can really impact our lives. And I think about, you know, my children and one day their children. And so, I'm just impressed. So kudos to you for doing this work. And I know that it's not easy work. Like, I know this is not, you probably could have chosen, you have a huge career, yeah, a wealth of knowledge and information. I am certain you could have chosen a much easier job and been okay. But the fact that you're choosing this path, creating your own path, really, because I don't think this wasn't laid out before you. Nobody gave you the roadmap to like economic right. equality and justice. Like, so I'm impressed. I'm just, you know, taking it all in. So thank you sincerely. Thank you.
Thank you for that feedback, Lisa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely echo that. Like, you know, stumbling upon your content and discovering your laser focus and your points of strategic, you know, like the strategic implementation of your focus and how this is how we get everyone to mobilize and to get on the same page for the same thing was mind-blowing to me. And I just felt so like grateful that your work existed, that you, again, like Lisa said, you could be doing so many other things that are probably, you know, much easier on your life, and you're choosing this path. And I just, again, we just offer so much gratitude for this work that you're doing. I think it's incredibly important work, which is why I was like, would you like to come on the podcast? I don't know how you made time for us, but I'm like, would you like to? So, but before we let you go, we have to ask the big Feeling Lighter podcast question to you. What is a belief that you once had that you no longer have that has impacted your life in a meaningful way?
I think it's an awakening to the reality that all of us have been victimized by this sin called racism in some way. All of us have a right to be angry at it. None of us owns a monopoly on the anger associated with it, even though we experience it very differently. Mm-hmm. And that because of that, we all can lead in the evisceration of this word, not one race or the other, but we all, with the ideology that I just mentioned, can lead well in this space, but we must do so kind of in concert. So I now believe in the power of resetting and restoring humanity with a more fulsome kind of approach.
I love that.
That is so powerful. And again, I've learned so much in the short time in the last year that I've been following your work. So thank you so much for opening my eyes, for opening so many eyes to a different path, mm-hmm. A path that is clearly more fruitful. Yeah. So mm-hmm. Where can people find you? Because again, people can join the Rare Woman Collective. They can go to an event. They can be a part of your community. They can have Harper and Slade come into their company. Like where can people find you?
Yep. So a couple things. So we have two websites I'd point your listeners to. One is my name, www.nikkilanier.com. And that has like all the stuff that we do, all the bodies of work. HarperSlade.com, H-A-R-P-E-R. SLADE.com is my business where we do the consulting and advisory work for organizations. Of course, the Rare Woman Collective, our inclined women program suite, and Rare has two A's. So it's Radical Action Advancing Racial Equity, RareWomanCollective.com. And then we are headed to, we've got a lot of offerings with Rare now. We're headed to Denver on April 5th. And then we're headed to the DMV area on April 13th for Rare on the Road. So we are doing this traveling workshop. Registration is open now on our Rare Women Collective website, as is our course, our online course offering, and our subscription services. You can get in our Facebook group. I don't know. I'm on LinkedIn like a crazy person. So everywhere. I'm always on there. So you can reach out to me there. Lots of ways to stay in contact.
Awesome.
We will include all of that in the show notes for our listeners. And I encourage everyone who's listening to check out Nikki's work, because it, again, I clearly have spoken to how much I really appreciate it. So thank you again, Nikki. And we will catch everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's show. Now, before you go, it would mean a lot to us if you could take a moment right now to subscribe to the podcast and then leave us a review. This helps spread the word so more people can feel lighter by shedding one belief at a time. Also, we want to hear from you. So if this episode impacted you or you have any questions that you think would be great for us or any of our future guests, please feel free to email us at podcast@weshape.com. And finally, if you want to try WeShape's different approach to health and fitness, make sure you click the link in our podcast description or go to weshape.com/free, where you can build your first workout and activate your 2-week free trial. See you next week.